You're listening to From the Public Domain, stories and excerpts from the public domain. I'm your host, Susie Alphins. Today I'll be beginning a series from Alaska, the Great Country, by Ella Higginson. The copyright date of this is 1910, so this is Alaska in the very early 1900s. If you would like to read the entire book, it's available at gutenberg.org. And again, her name is Ella Higginson. This will be edited for radio. When the Russians first came to the island of Unalaska, they were told that a vast country lay to the eastward and that its name was Al-A-Ek-Sa. Their own island, the Aleuts called Nagan-Aleyeksa, meaning the land lying near Aleyeksa. The Russians in time came to call the country itself Alashka, the peninsula, Alyeska, and the island, Unalashka. Alaska is an English corruption of the original name. A great Russian moved under inspiration when he sent Vitus Bering out to discover and explore the continent lying to the eastward. Two great Americans, Seward and Sumner, were inspired when nearly a century and a half later, they saved for us, in the face of the bitterest opposition, scorn, and ridicule, the country that Bering discovered, and which is now coming to be recognized as the most glorious possession of any people. But first of all, were the gentle, dark-eyed Aleuts, inspired when they bestowed upon this same country, with the simplicity and dignified repression for which their character is noted, the beautiful and poetic name which means the Great Country. Alaska, the Great Country, Chapter 1. Every year, from June to September, thousands of people go to Alaska. This means that they take passage at Seattle on the most luxurious steamers that run up the famed Inside Passage to Juneau, Sitka, Wrangell, and Skagway. Formerly, this voyage included a visit to Muir Glacier, but because of the ruin wrought by a recent earthquake, this once beautiful and marvelous thing is no longer included in the tourist trip. This 10-day voyage is unquestionably a delightful one. Every imaginable comfort is provided, and the excursion rate is reasonable. However, the person who contents himself with this will know as little about Alaska as a foreigner who landed in New York, went straight to Niagara Falls, and returned at once to his own country would know about America. Enchanting though this brief cruise may be, when the weather is favorable, the real splendor, the marvelous beauty, the poetic and haunting charm of Alaska lie west of Sitka. To westward is called this dream voyage past 1,000 miles of snow mountains rising straight from the purple sea and wrapped in coloring that makes it seem as though all the roses, lilies, and violets of heaven had been pounded to a fine dust and sifted over them, past green islands and safe harbors, past the Malaspina and the Columbia's glaciers, past Yakutat, Kayak, Cordova, Valdez, Seward, and Cook Inlet, and then, still on, to westward, past Kodiak Island, where the Russians made their first permanent settlement in America in 1784, whose sylvan and idyllic charm won the heart of the great naturalist, John Burroughs, past the Alyeska Peninsula, with its smoking Mount Pavlov, past Unimak Island, one whose active volcanoes, Shishaldin, is the most perfect and symmetrical cone on the Pacific coast, not even excepting Hood, and on and in among the divinely pale green Aleutian Islands to Unalaska, where enchantment broods in a mist of rose and lavender, and where one may scarcely step without crushing violets and bluebells. The spell of Alaska falls upon every lover of beauty who has voyaged along those far northern, snow-pearled shores with the violet waves of the North Pacific Ocean breaking splendidly upon them, or who has drifted down the mighty rivers of the interior which flow, bell-toned and lonely, to the sea. I know not how the spell is wrought, nor have I ever met one who could put the miracle of its working into words. No writer has ever described Alaska. No one writer ever will. But each must do his share, according to the spell that the country casts upon him. Some parts of Alaska lull the senses drowsily by their languorous charm. Under their influence, one sinks to a passive delight and drifts unresistingly on through a maze of tender loveliness. Nothing irritates. All is soft, velvety, soothing. Wordless lullabies are played by different shades of blue, rose, amber, and green, by the curl of the satin waves and the musical kiss of their cool and faltering lips, by the mists, light as thistledown and delicately tinted as wild rose petals, into which the steamer pushes leisurely, by the dreamy poise of seabirds on white or lavender wings high in the golden atmosphere, by the undulating flight of purple shadow, tiptoe through the dim fjords, by the lap of waves on shingle, the song of birds along the wooded shore, the pressure of soft winds on the temples and hair, the sparkle of sea weighing the eyelids down. The magic of it all gets into the blood. The steamer slides through green and echoing reaches, past groups of totems standing like ghosts on the past among the dark spruce or cedar trees, through stone-walled canyons where the waters move dark and still into open, sunlit seas. But it is not until one sails on to westward that the spell of Alaska falls upon one, sails out into the wild and splendid North Pacific Ocean. Here are the majesty, the sublimity that enthrall. Here are the noble spaces, the titanic forces, the untrodden heights that thrill and inspire. The marvels here are not the marvels of men. They are wrought of fire and stone and snow by the tireless hand that has worked through centuries unnumbered and unknown. He that would fall under the spell of Alaska will sail on to westward, on to Unalaska, or he will go northward and drift down the Yukon, that splendid, lonely river that has its birth within a few miles of the sea, yet flows 2,300 miles to find it. Alaskan steamers usually sail between 8 o'clock in the evening and midnight. The throngs of people congregate upon the piers of Seattle to watch their departure. The rosy purples and violets of sunset mix with the mists and settle upon the city, climbing white over its hills as hours go by. Its lights sparkle brilliantly through them. Yet still, the crowds sway upon the piers and wait for the first still motion of the ship as it slides into the night and heads for the far, enchanted land, the land whose sweet, insistent calling never ceases for the one who has once heard it. Passengers who stay on deck late will be rewarded by the witchery of night on Puget Sound, the soft fragrance of the air, the scarlet, blue, and green lights wavering across the water, the glistening wake of the ship, the city glimmering faintly as it is left behind, the dim shores of islands and the dark shadows of bays. One by one, the lighthouses at West Point on the starboard side and at Point No Point, Marrowstone, and Point Wilson on the port flash their golden messages through the dusk. One by one rise, linger, and fade the dark outlines of Magnolia Bluff, Skagit Head, Double Bluff, and Lip Lip Point. If the sailing be early in the evening, midnight is saluted by the lights of Port Townsend, than which no city on the Pacific coast has a bolder or more beautiful situation. After passing the lighthouse on the eastern end of Vancouver Island, Alaskan steamers continue on a northerly course and enter the Gulf of Georgia through Active Pass between Maine and Galiana Islands. This pass is guarded by a light on Main Island to the steamer's starboard going north. The Gulf of Georgia is a bold and sweeping body of water. It is usually of a deep violet or warm purplish gray in tone. At its widest, it is fully 60 miles, although its average width is from 20 to 30 miles, and it rolls between the mainland and Vancouver Island for more than 100 miles. The real sea lover will find an indescribable charm in this gulf and will not miss an hour of it. It has the boldness and the sweep of the ocean, but the setting, the coloring, and the fragrance of the forest-bordered, snow-peaked sea. A few miles above the boundary, the Fraser River pours its turbulent waters into the gulf, upon whose dark surface they wind and float for many miles, at sunrise and at sunset, resembling broad ribbons of palest old rose crinkled over waves of silvery amber silk. At times, these narrow streaks widen into still pools of color that seem to float, suspended over the heavier waters of the Gulf. Other times, they draw lines of different color everywhere, or drift solid banks of smoky pink out to meet others of clear blue, with only the faintest thread of pearl to separate them. These islands of color constitute one of the charms of this part of the voyage to Alaska. Along with the velvety pressure of the winds, the picturesque shores, high and wooded in places, and in others, sloping down into the cool, shadowy bays where the shingle is splashed by spent waves, and the snow peaks linked above the clouds on either side of the steamer. Splendid phosphorescent displays are sometimes witnessed in the Gulf, but are more likely to occur farther north in Grenville or one of the other narrow channels where their brilliancy is remarkable. Tourists to whom a whale is a novelty will be gratified without fail in this vicinity. They are always seen sporting about the ships, sometimes in deadly conflict with one another, and now and then, uncomfortably near. In December 1907, an exciting battle between a whale and a large buck was witnessed by the passengers and crew of the steamer Cassiar in one of the bays north of Vancouver on the vessel's regular run from that city to northern ports. When the Cassiar appeared upon the scene, the whale was making furious and frequent attacks upon the buck, racing through the water, which was lashed into foam on all sides by its efforts. It would approach close to its steadily swimming prey and then disappear, only to come to the surface almost under the deer. This was repeated a number of times, strangely enough, without apparent injury to the deer. Again, the whale would make its appearance at the side of the deer and repeatedly endeavor to strike it with its enormous tail. But the deer was sufficiently wise to keep so close to the whale that this could not be accomplished, notwithstanding the crushing blows dealt by the monster. The humane passengers entreated the captain to go to the rescue of the exhausted buck and save it from the inevitable death. The captain ordered full speed ahead, and at the approach of the steamer, the whale curved up out of the water and dived gracefully into the sea, as though making a farewell, apologetic bow on its final disappearance. Whereupon the humane passengers shot the helpless and worn-out buck at the side of the steamer, and he was hauled aboard. It may not be out of place to devote a few pages to the average tourist, to the one who loves Alaska and the divinely blue, wooded, and snow-pearled ways that lead to its final and sublime beauty. It is an enduring mystery why certain persons, usually women, should make this voyage. Their minds and their desires never rise above a whale or an Indian basket, and unless the one is to be seen and the other to be priced, they spend their time in the cabin, reading, playing cards, or telling one another what they have at home. "Do you know," said one of these women, yawning into the full glory of a sunset, "we have sailed this whole day past Vancouver Island. Not a thing to be seen but it and this water you call the Gulf of Georgia. I even missed the whales because I went to sleep, and I'd rather have seen them than anything. If they don't hurry up some towns and totem poles, I'll be wishing I'd stayed at home. Do you play 500? The full length of the Jefferson was not enough to put between this woman and the woman who had enjoyed every one of those purple water miles, every pearly cloud that had drifted across the pale blue sky, every bay and fjord indenting the shore of the largest island on the Pacific coast, every hummingbird that had throbbed about us, seeking a rose at sea, every thrilling scent that had blown down the northern waterways, bearing the far, sweet call of Alaska to senses awake and trembling to receive it, who had felt her pulses beating full to the throb of the steamer that was bearing her on to the land of her dreams, to the land of far delight. If only the players of bridge and the drinkers of pink tea would stay at home and leave this enchanted voyage for those who understand. There be enough of the elect in the world who possess the usual five senses, as well as that sixth sense, which is of the soul, to fill every steamer that sails for Alaska. Or the steamship companies might divide their excursions into classes, some for those who love beauty, and some for those who love bridge. For the sea lover, It is enough only to stand in the bow of a steamer headed for Alaska and hear the kiss and the rippling murmur of the waves as they break apart when the sharp cut water pierces them, and then their long musical rush along the steamer's sides, ere they reunite one broad wake of bowling silver that leads across the purple toward home. The mere vibration of a ship in these still inland seas is a physical pleasure by day and a sensuous lullaby at night, while in summer, the winds are so soft that their touches seem like caresses. The inlets and fjords extending for miles into the mainland in this vicinity are of great beauty and grandeur, many winding for 40 or 50 miles through walls of forestation and snow that rise sheer to a height of 8 or 10,000 feet. These inlets are very narrow, sometimes mere clefts, through which the waters slip, clear, still, and of deepest green. They are of unknown depth. The mountains are covered with forests, over which rise peaks of snow. Cascades are numerous, and their musical fall is increased in these narrow fastnesses to a roar that may be heard for miles. The wild and picturesque beauty of these inlets has been praised by tourists for many years. Passing Cape Mudge Lighthouse, Discovery Passage, sometimes called Valdez Narrows, is entered. It is a narrow pass, 24 miles long, between Vancouver and Valdez Islands. Halfway through it is Seymour Narrows, one of the most famous features of the Inside Route, or Passage to Alaska. Passengers are awakened, if they desire, that they may be on deck while passing through these difficult narrows. The Indian name of this pass is Yakulta. "Yakulta is a wicked spirit," said the pilot, pacing the bridge at 4 o'clock of a primrose dawn. "She lives down in the clear depths of these waters and is supposed to entice guileless sailors to their doom. Yakulta sleeps only at slack tide, and then boats or ships may slip through in safety, provided they do not make sufficient noise to awaken her. If they try to go through at any other stage of the tide, Yakulta stirs the whole pass into action, trying to get hold of them. Many's the time I've had to back out and wait for Yakulta to quiet down. If the steamer attempts the pass at an unfavorable hour, fearful seas are found racing through at a 14-knot speed. The steamer is flung from side to side of the rocky pass or sucked down into the boiling whirlpools by Yakulta, the brown, shining strands of kelp floating upon Ripple Reef, which carries a sharp edge down the center of the pass, are the wild locks of Yakulta's luxuriant hair. Pilots figure upon leaving Seattle to reach the narrows during the quarter hour before or after slack tide, when the water is found as still and smooth as satin, stretched from shore to shore, and not even Yakulta's breathing disturbs her liquid coverlet. Many vessels were wrecked here before the dangers of the narrows had become fully known. 3 miles below Cape Mudge, the tides from Juan de Fuca meet those from Queen Charlotte Sound and force a 14-knot current through the narrows. The most powerful steamers are frequently overcome and carried back by this current. Discovery Passage merges at Chatham Point into Johnstone Strait. Here the first Indian village, Alert Bay, is seen to starboard on the southern side of Cormorant Island. These are the Kwakiutl Indians, who did not at first respond to the advances of civilization so readily as most northern tribes. They came from their original village at the mouth of the Nimkish River to work in the canneries on the bay, but did not take kindly to the ways of the white man. A white child, said to have been stolen from Vancouver, was taken from these Indians a few years ago. Some fine totem poles have been erected here, and the graveyard has houses built over the graves. From the steamer, the little village presents an attractive appearance, situated on a curving beach with wooded slopes rising behind it. Gorgeous potlatches are held here, and until the spring of 1908, these orgies were rendered more repulsive by the sale of young girls. Fort Rupert, on the northern end of Vancouver Island, is an old Hudson Bay post, situated on Beaver Harbor. The fort was built in 1849 and was strongly defended, troubles frequently arising from the attacks of the Kwakiutl and Haida Indians. Great potlatches were held there, and the chief's lodge was as notable as was the Old Man House of Chief Seattle. It was 100 feet long and 80 feet wide, and rested on carved corner posts. there was an immense wood potlatch dish that held food for 100 people. Queen Charlotte Sound is a splendid sweep of purple water, but tourists do not, usually, spend much time enjoying its beauty. Their berths possess charms that endure until shelter of the islands is once more assured, after the 40 miles of open exposure to the swell of the ocean, which is not always mild, notwithstanding its name. Those who miss it miss one of the most beautiful features of the inland voyage. The warm breath of the Kurosaiwo, penetrating all these inland seas and passages, is converted by the great white peaks of the horizon into pearl-like mist that drifts in clouds and fragments upon the blue waters. Nowhere are these mists more frequent nor more elusive than in Queen Charlotte Sound. They roll upon the sparkling surface like thistledown along a country lane, here one instant, vanished the next. At sunrise, they take on the delicate tones of the primrose or the pinkish starflower. At sunset, all the royal rose and purple blendings, all the warm flushes of amber, orange, and gold. Through a maze of pale yellow, whose fine, cool needles sting one's face and set one's hair with seed pearls, one passes into a little open water world where a blue sky sparkles above a bluer sea, and the air is like clear washed gold. But a mile ahead, a solid wall of amethyst closes in this brilliant sea, and presently the steamer glides into it, shattering it into particles that set the hair with amethysts instead of pearls. Sometimes these clear spaces resemble rooms, walled in different colors, but sealed and floored in blue. Other times the whole sound is clear, blue, shining, while exquisite gossamers of changeful tints wrap and cling about the islands, wind scarfs around the green hills, or set upon the brows of majestic snow monarchs, crowns as jeweled and as evanescent as those worn by the real kings of the earth. Now and then a lofty fir or cedar may be seen draped with slender mist veils, as a maiden might wind a scarf of cobwebby lace around her form and head and arms, so lightly and so gracefully, and with such art do the delicate folds trail in and out among the emerald green branches of the tree. It is this warm and excessive moisture, this daily mist shower, that bequeaths to British Columbia and Alaska their marvelous and luxuriant growth of vegetation, their spiced sweetness of atmosphere, their fairness and freshness of complexion, blending and constituting that indescribable charm which inspires one, standing on the deck of a steamer at early dawn, to give thanks to God that he is alive and sailing the blue waterways of this sublime country. "I don't know what it is that keeps pulling me back to this country," said a man in the garb of a laborer one day. He stood down in the bow of the steamer. His hands were in his pockets. His throat was bared to the wind. His blue eyes, sunken, but burning with that fire which never dies in the eyes of one who loves nature, were gazing up the pale green narrow avenue named Grenville Channel. "It's something that you can't exactly put into words. You don't know that it's got hold of you while you're up here. But before you've been outside a month, all at once you find it pulling at you. And after it begins, it never lets up. You try to think what it is up here that you want so, what it is that keeps begging at you to come back. Maybe there ain't a darn soul up here you care particular about. Maybe you ain't got an interest in a claim worth hen's teeth. Maybe you're broke and know you'll have to work like a go-devil when you get here. It don't make any difference. It's just Alaska. It calls you and calls you and calls you. Maybe you can't come, so you keep pretending you don't hear. But Lord, do you hear? Maybe somebody shakes hands as if he liked you, and there's Alaska up and calling right through you till you feel your heart shake. Maybe a phonograph sets up a tune they used to deal out at Magnuson's Roadhouse on the trail, and you hear that blame lonesome waterfall up in Keystone Canyon calling you as plain as you hear the phonograph. Maybe you smell something like the sun shining on snow, all mixed up with tundra and salt air, and there's double-quick action on your eyes and a lump in your throat that won't be swallowed down. Maybe you see a white mountain, or a green valley, or a big river, or a blue strait, or a waterfall. And like a flash, your heart opens and shuts in an ache for Alaska that stays. No, I don't know what it is, but I do know how it is. And so does every other poor devil that ever heard that something calling him. That's just Alaska. It wakes you up in the middle of the night, just as plain as if somebody had said your name out loud. And you just lay there the rest of the night, aching to go. I tell you what, if ever a country had a spirit, it's Alaska. And when it once gets hold of you and gets to calling you to come, you might just as well get up and start. For it calls you and follows you and haunts you till you do. It is the pleading of the mountains and the pleading of the sea woven into one call and sent floating down laden with the sweetness of the splendid spaces. No mountaineer can say why he goes back to the mountains. No sailor why he cannot leave the sea. No one has yet seen the spirit that dwells in the waterfall, but all have heard it calling and have known its spell. If you love the sea, you've got to follow it, said a sea rover. And that's all there is to it. A man can get along without the woman he loves best on earth, if he has to. But he can't get along without the sea, if he once gets to loving it. It gets so it seems like a thing alive to him, and it makes up for everything else that he don't have. And it's just like that with Alaska. When a man has made 2-3 trips to Alaska, you can't get him off on a southern run again, as long as he can help himself. It is an unimaginative person who can wind through these intricate and difficult sounds, channels, and passes without a strange, quickened feeling, as of the presence of those dauntless navigators who discovered and charted these waters centuries ago. From Juan de Fuca northward, they seem to be sailing with us, those grim, brave specters of the past. Perez, Meres, Cuadra, Valdez, Malaspina, Duncan, Vancouver, Whidbey, and all the others who came and went through these beautiful ways, leaving their names or the names of their monarchs, friends, or sweethearts to endure in blue stretches of water or glistening domes of snow. We sail in safety, ease, luxury, over courses along which they felt their perilous way, never knowing whether life or death waited at the turn of the prow. Nearly a century and a quarter ago, Vancouver, working his way cautiously into Queen Charlotte Sound, soon came to disaster, both the Discovery and her consort, the Chatham, striking upon the rocks that border the entrance. Fortunately, the return of the tide in a few hours released them from their perilous positions before they had sustained any serious damage. But what days of mingled indecision, hope, and despair. What nights of anxious watching and waiting must have been spent in these places through which we glide so easily now, and the silent spirits of the grim peopled past take hold of our heedless hands and lead us on. Does a pilot sail these seas who has never on wild nights felt beside him on the bridge the presence of those early ones who, staring ever ahead under stern brows, drove their vessels on, not knowing what perils lay beyond? Who asked, "What shall we do when hope be gone?" Made answer, "Why, sail on, and on, and on." We'll continue next week with Alaska, the Great Country, by Ella Higginson. Copyright 1910. You've been listening to From the Public Domain. I'm your host, Susie Elthens.